I'm TJ Manisterski, and this is my Coaching Project podcast, where I connect with leaders in search of breakthrough knowledge. Breakthrough knowledge challenges the status quo, changes your opinion, or fundamentally opens your eyes in a way that there's no turning back. You can subscribe to the Coaching Project monthly newsletter at tjmanisterski.com, and you can find the direct link in the show notes. Today, I've got a guest, Carlo Colaiacovo. Carlo was drafted first round, 17th overall by the Toronto Maple Leafs, which turned into a 16-year professional hockey playing career, with 14 of those years in the National Hockey League with the Toronto Maple Leafs, St. Louis Blues, Detroit Red Wings, Philadelphia Flyers, and Buffalo Sabres. And then finally, putting a bow on it in Germany with Adler Mannheim for two seasons. Carlo represented Team Canada five times, under 17, twice at the World Juniors, once in the Men's World Championships, and once in the Spengler Cup. He's now in the media as a TSN hockey analyst and has his own radio show with Michael Landsberg, First Up, on TSN 1050. Carlo, welcome to the Coaching Project.
Tej, what's up, man? I'm excited about this project you got going on.
Thanks, buddy. It's great to see you, and great to have you here. And we're just a few short days away from the start of the World Junior Hockey Championships. And every television set in Canada is going to be locked in, and every hockey family in the world will be paying attention. And when looking at the Canadian team, it's amazing the pedestal we put these young men on and the amount of pressure they must perform under. And I think it's lost on many of the viewers that these are just teenagers.
Yeah.
This is an under 20 tournament. Yet, if you go by the numbers, like, it's less likely to make Team Canada's World Junior team than it is the NHL. So very few people have actually experienced what that's like, including some of the best hockey players in the world. And I want you to take us into that world. And we're going to start with a period of time that must have been as fast-paced as anything you've ever experienced. And we're going to begin in the spring of 2001, and you're drafted to the Maple Leafs as a Toronto kid. Less than a year later, early spring 2002, you win the OHL championship with the Erie Otters, compete for the Memorial Cup. December of that same year, you get set to compete in the World Juniors for Canada. So when you reflect back on that period of time, what is the storyline that plays in your head?
Well, I mean, a lot plays into my head. I mean, I played minor hockey with you. And during our minor hockey years, we were just playing for fun. And all of a sudden, we get to our draft year and things start to become more serious, where you're starting to talk to scouts, you get drafted. And next thing you know, the real hockey starts to begin. I think I can say this, you know, many, many times and feel good about saying, is I never expected to be drafted by the Toronto Maple Leafs. And that was the biggest surprise to me when it happened. And it was a decision and a moment that changed my life forever, because growing up in Toronto, understanding Toronto Maple Leaf hockey and appreciating everything that comes with it, you don't really know until you live it. And I was just a young kid, you know, watching hockey, and now about to live the dream that, you know, every Toronto kid has growing up watching their beloved Maple Leafs. And instant celebrity. You know, everywhere you go, people are recognizing you. People are talking about you. You know, the same thing with my parents, because they were pretty highly broadcasted on the TV when I got drafted. So they became popular people too. But what you really start to learn at that stage is what it takes to make that next level. And a lot of it is having a level head, being confident in yourself, being confident in your abilities, and being confident in your surroundings. You know, I was a young 18-year-old when I got drafted, and I walked into a locker room full of older players, you know, older players that I looked up to and watched, like Matt Sundin, Darcy Tucker, Ryan McCabe, all these guys that you idolized and watched. And now you're in this locker room with them. So you kind of, you want to hold back your surreal feeling of being in a room full of celebrities, because you also want to have the feeling knowing that you belong. So for me, it was luckily for me, this all started at 16 years old, where I moved away from home to play junior hockey. And that helped me mature right away, grow up as a 16-year-old, because I learned to live away from my family. I learned how to take care of myself. And I feel like those characteristics really, really helped me in that environment where I could go show respect, be mature, and ultimately focus on what I love to do. And that was play hockey. At that point, you're always concentrating on letting your voice or letting your play do the talking. Because if you don't show up and play, nothing else matters. And obviously with the expectation of me being a first-round pick in Toronto, the limelight was on me. So I felt like the pressure was there for me to perform, but I never really viewed it as pressure. I always embraced pressure situations because I wanted to use those as benchmarks to compare myself against other people that were labeled the best either at my age group or the best at my job at playing hockey. So I always used it as a competitive edge for me, knowing that in every situation, you know, I focused on doing the best I could to be the best I could in those situations. And luckily for me, I didn't get a chance to really experience my first training camp because, it was the same time as the 9/11 tragedy that our world was struck by. So I had to wait a full year, which allowed me to go back to junior. And going back to junior, you know, you have this label on you of being a first-round pick. Everywhere you go, especially in the Ontario Hockey League, you know, the focus is on you because you're a Toronto boy for the Toronto Maple Leafs. But ultimately, I just wanted to be the best player on my team and help my team accomplish as much as it possibly could. Because, you know, individual accomplishments always get magnified when there's, you know, team success. And I was lucky to have that in Erie where I played. And so you talked about, you know, making the World Junior team. That was something that, you know, came with that season of, you know, being drafted, starting off really well, playing on a really good team, being one of the best players on a really good team. And it just started to snowball in a positive manner after that. But at the same time, I never lost track of what I needed to do on a daily basis or I needed to do on a season basis to continue to grow and continue to develop to ultimately carve out the year that the career that I was able to do.
It's interesting what you mentioned there about how you viewed pressure. Like you didn't see it as pressure, you use it as a benchmark. And I think that's such a positive way to turn that pressure into a positive stress, right? Like you're using it as a measuring stick. Mm-hmm. So that implies in itself that this isn't a finite end all determination of who I am. Like if I fail here or if it doesn't go well, it's just a measuring stick of where I'm at and I can re-attack this. It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, I'm no good. And I also think listening to you found a way to develop as a person and you built those character strengths that stayed with you, like your maturity you mentioned,
yeah,
as a young guy moving away and keeping a level head and being focused on the things that you had to do that led to some of that success. I also see there's some real challenges from a development standpoint in that structure, that calendar that you were living under, because if mm-hmm. you think about you play in the Memorial Cup, which ends like When does the Memorial Cup end? What month?
Probably the end of May.
Okay. So the end of May. And when would Team Canada selection camps begin for the World Juniors?
Early December.
So you didn't have a summer camp in those days?
Yeah. Yeah, we did. So they'd have like those development camps where you're part of a group of players that they've identified as potential candidates for sure. Those camps for me were more of education than pressure because you're going to a situation where you're competing against the best guys at your own age level and you're learning who you're up against and who you're going to compete against to try to make this team. And you're learning, you know, the things that they're going to look for, the things that they're going to identify for different situations that are going to help orchestrate a team. And you're wondering where you fit in those situations, but you're also doing it to build relationships. And that's the one thing that I've never lost track of is Every environment that you walk into, you want to make sure that you're leaving with something positive, whether it's with your performance, whether it's with something you learned, or whether it's just you've found new friends, because ultimately relationships help educate you down the road too, because you're up against the same guys at every next, checkpoint, because not only do you have, you have development camp, now you have training camps with your own team, now you have a season, then you've got actual World Junior camp, then you got the World Junior team, then you got the NHL draft. So you're competing against the same guys that you're with in the summertime that whole way through. And you just want to keep using your performance as a measuring stick and paying attention to what everybody else is doing around you. You talked about pressure. In the beginning, I didn't really feel any pressure when I was at my first Maple Leaf camp or even at my first development camp, because it was probably a place that I never envisioned myself being. So I was just trying to absorb everything at once. Where I really felt the most pressure is my second camp, my second Maple Leafs camp and my second World Junior camp. I'll start with my Maple Leafs camp first. I think my first Maple Leafs camp, I went in with no expectations. I just wanted to play well and leave a good impression. Well, I exceeded all that. I ended up, earning my way onto the roster, earning a contract, earning a chance to play in the NHL. What I think I lost focus of in my second year was what I did and how hard I worked to get to that point, because I felt like there was so much of a spotlight on me in the second year that I forgot what I needed to do to stand out. Well, really all I needed to do to stand out was just be myself, but I just felt like I needed to do more than what I did in the first year to stand out even more. And ultimately I ended up putting a lot of a pressure on myself because I just felt like I had to make the perfect play doing everything instead of just making the simple play. And I learned this after, because what happened that following year, there was expectation that I was going to make the team, and I didn't end up making the team that year because my play didn't meet the expectation. And a lot of it was because I went in, instead of feeling confident in myself, I went in, started thinking about everything else around me, the competition around me, the decisions that needed to be made, whether or not I was going to have a spot on the team, which were really out of my control. And ultimately, I paid the price. I ended up not making the team, and I ended up starting the year in the minors. And maybe that was a good thing. Maybe it was a bad thing. I think it delayed my development because now I was dealt with questioning myself, which is something I never really wanted to do. But I also felt like it was a good thing because it allowed me to appreciate how hard I worked the first go around and how much more I need to do to make sure I get there again. And it's sort of the one things that I always stress with people that are in hockey that want to make the NHL. One thing I always learned, and one thing guys will always tell you that have played in the NHL, that the easiest part of hockey when you're at that level is making it to the NHL. Because when you come in with the credentials that I came in with as the profile of being a first round pick, an offensive defenseman, a really skilled player, a potential prospect, you're always going to get more chances to see if you can stick. The hardest part about the NHL is staying there, because once you're there, you've been given that opportunity. But once you're there, it's what are you going to do with that opportunity, which is why it's the hardest thing to say. Sometimes guys get there and they forget how hard they needed to work to get there and just become complacent. And the next guy behind them is pushing past them. Now, I was lucky enough to realize that early and continue to push through the struggles that I was having. But I faced the same situation in my second World Junior camp, where I went into my first World Junior camp and I felt like I could do no wrong. Like I just, everything was clicking for me, and I wasn't going to make the decision. I was going to make it easy on them to select me on the team because there were so many things I was doing well, which ultimately was what I did. I made the team in my first camp because I had an outstanding camp, coming off a really good start of the season, and make the team, go to Czech Republic, have a great tournament in the limited role that I played as a younger player, and came out with a silver medal. the next year I went in as one of three or four returning players, and you start, I don't know, for whatever reason, you start having doubts because you know the competition is just as good as the year before. And the sort of the common thing at World Junior camps is that if you're a returning player, you have an automatic spot on the team for the next year. But we've seen instances as well that in certain situations, that doesn't always happen. You still have to perform. So I went into that camp again thinking, okay, I'm a veteran guy. You know, I got an easy spot on the team, but I forgot that I needed to still play the game and play at my best. And I felt like I wasn't doing that until a coach pulled me inside and said, hey, is everything okay with you? Because, you know, you look like you're struggling out there. And I don't know if it was just me not being mentally focused at the time because I just wanted to get into game action and I wanted to get to the tournament and play. But I forgot about the important step of before getting to that tournament and play is I had to still set an example of being a returning player and earning my keep. And I stressed myself out over it. Because now I start questioning, am I doing the right things? You know, you start hearing rumblings about being the captain of the team or part of the leadership group, and now I'm focusing on that. And so that's why it's really important, you know, to stress the message of focus on the things that you can control and let the outside noise stay on the outside. Because if you don't control the things you control, none of those other decisions matter. Because you're basically you're making the decision for easy for somebody who is evaluating you that, you know what, your mind's not there. Now, ultimately, one thing I gave myself a lot of credit for even throughout my career was I was able to block out the distractions. And when I was ready to take on the task of preparing for the moment, that was my strength. Because once the tournament started, it's like my confidence came right back to me. Okay, the relief is over. I don't have to question myself. Am I going to make the team? Am I not going to make the team? Dude, I was having restless nights thinking about this because, you know, you don't want to be that guy that ends up being the example of a guy being cut who's a returning player. And, you know, it ended up, you know, working out in the best case scenario for me. I was one of the best players on the team. I led the tournament in scoring as a defenseman. I had an outstanding tournament. And that was a momentum point for me that catapulted me to have a long stretch run into my junior season where we went and won the OHL championship. And that, you know, helped me make the Maple Leafs the year after. So it really, the one thing that I've always even encouraged players to now is regardless of the opportunity that you have or the chances that you may get, make the most of it. And make the most of it by leaving an impression, whether it's a small impression, a big impression, whatever it is you're being asked to do, make sure you leave an impression when it is that you're doing it, because that's the lasting impression you want to leave with somebody who is evaluating you, especially the team like the Maple Leafs, where they see the performance that I was able to put on a big stage at the World Juniors in my home country on the biggest stage against kids or players at my own age level, and knowing that I could be a guy that could be counted on to be a legitimate NHLer, which ultimately was the path that I created for myself right off of that.
And making the most of it is something I've heard from you, Matt Stajan. You know, he's a great example of a guy who made the most of some opportunities. And
tell me about it. Every time something bad was about to happen to that guy, the guy caught a break of good luck. And man, that guy made $30 million being a fourth-line player in the NHL and played 1,000 games.
Right,
unbelievable. But credit to him, though, man. He stuck with it.
But he scored in his first World Junior game. He scored in his first game with the Maple Leafs.
Yeah.
Right? And when we chatted on this podcast a while back, he referenced how he would reject your notion of good luck. And he's saying that, you know, he was prepared for that, basically.
Yeah.
Right? But what you guys are both saying is about making the most of it and leaving an impression, because the chance comes. And if you don't make the most of it, it might not come back around when you're competing with the elite and the best of the best. And
well, it's like I said, Tej, the easiest part is getting there. The hardest part is staying there. If you're not there to make an impression, especially with the way hockey players are being developed nowadays, you could be just a number. not a name. And it's unfortunate the way it's going, but hockey has come such a long way with the development of younger players that if you're not doing what you believe your strengths are, somebody else will.
Right. But it's, so what you're saying sounds so simple, but it's very rare, I think, for people to be able to execute on. And when you talk about expectations, like you mentioned it, the difference between your first camp and the second camp, the only difference was the expectations that you had and the expectations of what the decision makers had on you.
Yeah.
You know, when you go in, it's the same thing right now. If you go into the World Juniors as Team Canada versus going into the World Juniors as Team Germany, the feelings of pressure, I would imagine,
are different.
Very, very different, right?
And just to touch on that, they're different too in the sense that the competition level is different. Canada probably has a greater group of guys that you have to compete against compared to some of these other countries where, you know, the expectation isn't the same as Canada, where every time you step onto the ice, you're expected to win the gold medal. Or with these other countries, you know, if you're playing on that team, the expectation is just to go out and play proud for your country.
Right.
Right.
So let's drill down on that. You go your first World Juniors, you win silver with a tough loss in Czech Republic to Russia. You come back the second year. You've just talked about your internal conflict of doubts and pressure going into that camp. But ultimately, you persevere, you get through, you make the team. But now you're heading into the next tournament as a veteran, a leader. You're being counted on. You've come off of a silver, which in Canada, talk about expectations, is not what the country is expecting. They're expecting gold.
Uh-huh.
And now you're going to play in the next tournament in Halifax, in Canada. Where does that come into play for you, like, in terms of, like, you clearly went and performed well. You led the team in scoring as a uh-huh. defenseman. But you get back to that gold medal game. It's all on the line again.
Yeah.
Against Russia again in Canada.
Yeah.
Think back to that locker room. Like, I'm getting chills thinking about it. I can't even imagine what that must have been like. Can you take me there and tell me the story you're thinking about?
Well, I hate Russia just because every Canadian opportunity I had, we lost to the Russians. I mean, my under 17, I lost to them in the gold medal game. Both World Juniors, I lost them in the gold medal game. My World Championship opportunity to Canada, we lost to them in the semifinals. Luckily, they didn't exist in the Spengler Cup. And maybe that's the one thing, one reason why we won the Spengler Cup. But emotions. You know, having the bitter taste from the year before, losing to them in the finals, and having some returning players was definitely something that motivated me a little more, and probably some of the returning guys, the three or four other returning guys, because you wanted that revenge. And, you know, as much as maybe in the beginning you were hoping you weren't going to face Russia, I was salivating at the chance to face Russia again, because you always, as a competitor, you always want to win the ultimate prize, you know, beating the team that you deserve to beat. And that to me was Russia. Now, go back to the game before in the semifinals where we played the Americans. And this was in Halifax, like you said, in Canada, playing for your country, in your own country. That place packed somewhere between 10 to 15,000 fans in the rink. And we're talking jam-packed. And probably one of the craziest, loudest environments that I've ever played in. And people waving Canadian flags, dressed in white, painted faces. Like, it was just the ultimate pride to play for your country in that moment. And that game was just as exciting, and the emotions that were going through us in that game. It was 2-2 with like 4 minutes left, and we scored a big goal. It was actually my D partner that scored a big goal to make it 3-2. And I remember the feeling in that moment of just having like the crowd just erupt, but knowing that the whole country was doing the same thing when that goal was scored. And so you're celebrating that emotion on the bench for the last 3 minutes of the game, ultimately holding on and winning that game to get us to the gold medal game, where that was our goal right from the tournament. Get to the gold medal game, get us a chance, either at a chance, get us a chance to either, you know, redeem ourselves and win a gold medal, or get some revenge against the Russians who we ultimately faced. And there was a day off between the game. And I think it was a day off that was well needed, because there was so much emotions going through me in particular. And I would imagine a lot of my other teammates too, where it just gave us a chance to wind down and process everything. And I believe it was an early afternoon game, that game in Halifax, the gold medal game. So you get up that morning. First of all, you go to bed that night. You can't really sleep much because you're just envisioning, you know, the celebration, or at least how your body's going to react, or what type of emotions you're going to go through. I know when we lost the year before, I was crying on the ice because it felt like it was ripped away from me. And I didn't want to be put in that situation again. I wanted to experience the joy of celebrating a gold medal on my home ice with the rest of my country. So leading up that night, you know, you don't sleep much. You get up in the morning and you just try to treat it as a normal game day, where you're trying to control your nerves. You're trying to control your emotions, but you're also trying to prepare yourself to play the best game and leave it all out there, which I never had a problem doing. When I got jacked up for a game, I knew what I needed to bring. So we had this, you know, coach comes in pregame, says his speech. It's starting to get, you know, closer to game time. It's starting to get a little bit more real. You go out to warmups and the building's full in warmups, and that normally doesn't happen. So you're now the hairs on your arms and on your body are starting to stand, right? You're starting to feel, you know, everything go through your body, the jolt. But you're just trying to soak it all in. You're looking across the ice, you see those pesky Russians that you just can't stand, and you know, a team that's got Alexander Ovechkin on it. You know, he was the talk of the team. But you're still trying to envision. Like, visualization is such a powerful tool in the game of hockey, for not only just, you know, mental prep, but, you know, just game prep and your overall, you know, body preparation on, you know, the structure that you want to create, you know, doing, practicing the same things on a daily basis, so it becomes routine for you. And so after warmups, you know, we go into the locker room, guys are starting to retape their sticks. And all you hear in our locker room, or right underneath the stands, is everybody starting to chant, "Let's go, go Canada, go Canada, go." And it's like, holy cow, like, we're about to step onto the ice. Like, this is about to happen. So we start marching onto the ice. And that's, you know, I mean, you've played the game too. One of the best feelings as a hockey player is when the game is about to start and you're walking down that runway into one of the most electric atmospheres ever, and they're all cheering for you. And so I was starting the game, like, I had to start the first shift, and I remember skating around, could barely breathe because of the emotions that were going through me, knowing that my family was in the stands probably celebrating the same thing that everybody else was going. And I'm just getting choked up talking about this because I'm reliving all this. I'm getting hair, or my hairs are starting to spike up and stuff. But at the same time, you're just trying to focus, saying, okay, control my emotions. You got to play a hockey game, and you got to be your best at playing it. And for me, like, going into that game, I was already having a really good tournament, and I knew I was going to be a guy that was going to be relied on to help us win this game. And so I remember when that first puck dropped and the puck came on my stick, I was just trying to tell myself, make a good first pass, settle the nerves, and then get into the game. And sometimes in those moments, you just got to lay a big hit or set yourself up to get hit so that you wake up and you finally tell yourself you're in the game. I remember making that first pass. It was the most crisp pass I've ever made, probably one of the hardest ones I've ever made, because I just wanted it off my stick. I didn't want to screw it up. So I pass it to my partner. And next thing you know, boom, I'm in the game. Okay, crowd's behind us. This is for the gold medal. We're playing against the Russians. It's revenge. But you're also trying to use that emotion to create a big play on the ice. And I think it was my second or third shift where I had a chance to lay a guy out. And I went for the big hit against the boards, and I missed him. But the sound of the boards just let the whole crowd erupt, because that's the way they do it. I played on a team with Jordan Tutu, where this guy, all he was doing was trying to go out and kill guys with hits. So once those first couple of shifts got through it, now it just feels like a normal hockey game, where you just want to go out and play your best and do the things that got you there. You know, like, lead by example with your play, make smart plays with the puck, and, you know, try to create plays that creates offense for you. We ended up having a scoreless first period. And so now you're in the locker room and, you know, you're like, okay, guys, we're here. We're in the moment. Let's go out and play the way we can and win this game. We come out in the second period, guns a-blazing. We're throwing everything at the net. We finally find a way to bounce a goal in. We go up 1-0. Crowds behind us going crazy. You're feeling yourself, okay, this is what we wanted. We wanted the lead on home ice. You know, let's play with the momentum now. A couple minutes later, they tie it. So I'm like, oh, okay, good. Now, not good, but like, crap. Like, this is now it's a game again. And we would have been nice to get that second goal and play with more of a comfort lead and then have them open up their game and maybe it'll create more chances for us. But we didn't let it hold us back. We found a way to get another goal just before the end of the period to go up 2-1. And so now we're going into the period with the lead. Now, going back to my year last year, there was a couple moments in the game in my first turnaround with the World Juniors where we were up 3-1 in the second period and we were up 4-3 in the third period. And we lost the game 5-4. So I knew this was a team we couldn't just sit back and protect the lead. And that was the one message I tried to stress. Not that I tried. I did stress with our group. I said, guys, we're in a great spot right now. We're going into the third period, 20 minutes of the best hockey of your life playing with the lead. Let's go out and find a way to get it done. And the couple other guys that were returning knew exactly what I was referring to. Because it's like, guys, we've already been here. We tried. We can't just sit back on it. Not to say we sat back on it, but obviously, you know, if you go back and look back at history, we end up losing the game 3-2. And they come out midway through the second period. They tie the game. And then they get a power play and they score a power play goal to go up 3-2. So it leaves us little time to come back in the game. But it just felt like you've exhausted already so much energy to get to that point that we couldn't manufacture anything after they got the lead on us to come back and tie it and find a way to win that game. And ultimately, we know how that ends. They win again. I end up, you know, having two cracks at a gold medal and only end up, you know, winning, not only end up, still proud to be a silver medal winner. And you just start to reflect of things you could have done differently. And for me, I don't know how much I could have done differently. I mean, it's a gold medal game. You're playing against the best competition in Russia. But you just want to feel satisfied that you left it all on the ice. And that's one thing that I felt grateful for, even though as tough as it is to admit losing again. Those are examples of situations where you can go one of two ways when you experience those types of defeats in your life. You could crumble and keep reminiscing about it, or you could use it as motivational points to want to continue to push to have more success, whether it's at the NHL level or any other opportunity that may come about, whether it's with world championships or just, you know, personal success. So, I mean, listen, a lot of guys don't, you talked about it earlier, the World Junior team is a hard team to make because you only have 2 years to make it, if that, maybe 1 year. Where the NHL, if you get drafted and get a chance, you know, you're going to get more of an opportunity either throughout the year of a long season or, you know, maybe somebody else liking you in a certain role. So that's how that ended. And listen, it's the Christmas time of the year. Every time this year comes up since that moment, we're talking almost 20 years from now. You start to relive those moments. And as much as I always cheer for Canada, it's still bittersweet. You know, when Canada wins, yeah, you're happy because that's what you cheer for. That's what you're born to love and born to do is cheer for Canada. But it's also, you know, there's a little bit of a sting there for me where I want to go back and relive those moments and get a chance to win that gold medal and celebrate it the way some of these kids do. So, that's the way life goes. And, you know, right now you just, again, I'm watching the game at a different perspective right now where you cheer for, I train a lot of these kids that are coming up through these programs. You cheer for those kids. And you try to monitor their success throughout their careers.
Wow. Great story.
And thanks, buddy.
Significant, adversity there to rebound from. And when you think about sustaining a career, like you mentioned earlier, it's one thing to make it to the NHL. It's another thing to stay in the NHL. And to have played 14 years in the league, there were moments of adversity for every player. And I know you had moments of adversity. how does one at that level, or how did you, I guess, is a better way of, how do you mentally deal with adversity? Like, this is an example, an injury is an example, you know, starting your second year in the minors is an example. I'm sure there's countless others, but your ability to learn from those obstacles or those setbacks and to ultimately persevere, you know, what are the skills that you think allowed you to do that, and that you would, as you mentioned, these players that you've trained and you've coached and other guys coming up, like how do you do that?
I think I'm a great example of being mentally tough and being able to block negative things out, because my NHL career got off to a rocky start in a pressure market in Toronto, where I experienced, you know, a rash of injuries, and it was year after year. And it was something that in this market was very difficult to navigate through, because everywhere you went and everywhere you watched, everywhere you listened, people were critiquing you and criticizing you. And I guess one of the things that I had a knack for was having like thick skin, where I was able to have people say things about me that just wouldn't bother me. Because at the end of the day, it's about having a good belief system. And I always trusted my belief system as the thing that would always conquer in those situations. And, you know, having that belief system where, you know, I was confident in my abilities. I was confident when, you know, healthy and given the right opportunity, I knew what type of player I could be. And I always wanted to continue to push to be that type of player. And I wasn't going to let anybody or anything hold me back from it. Now, I learned a lot in my early career, where the sense that the things I was doing and the things that were being told to me weren't always the right things, you know, as the more that I learned about it. But I could never turn back the clock and go fix it. I could always just focus on the things I needed to do to change it. And that was the hard thing for me to overcome, or at least move on from in Toronto, because as much as I wanted that to happen, it just felt like nobody around me was allowing it to happen, in the sense that they're always looking for a way to knock me down because of my past. And it just became so frustrating. It's like, hey, I don't want to focus on the past. The past is the past for a reason. I've been there. I've done that. I'm here now because I consider myself mentally strong to be in this moment, where I could have easily, you know, folded or at least let it break me, but I wasn't committed to do that. I was committed to make myself a better person from it, and committed to make myself the player and foresee the career that I envisioned for myself to get to that point. And that was something in Toronto that was becoming more and more difficult to move on from. So ultimately, one of the best things that's ever happened in my career, which, you know, I would say was the turning point in my career at the pro level, was me being traded. And as much as it was tough for me to envision at the time, it was something that I welcomed with open arms, because it allowed me to get a fresh start in a situation where I didn't have to be constantly reminded of things that, you know, haunted me. And I wouldn't say haunted me, but failed me in the past, because my injuries in Toronto didn't allow me to live up to the profile or the expectation that was granted for me when I got drafted. It was holding me back. But having that belief system, knowing that I just need somebody to trust me, I just need to be put in the position where I can show that I can still be that guy, you know, came to a point where I knew it wasn't going to happen in Toronto. So I get traded to St. Louis, and immediately my mindset changes, because when you get traded, you look at it as a door open and a door closed. The door open because there's a team out there that believes in you and is willing to give you the opportunity to play in that role. And then the door closes in Toronto in the sense that, all right, I can move on from that. I don't need to be constantly reminded of things I did in the past. As much as I would have loved to continue to change that narrative, it just felt it was becoming more and more difficult year after year. I go to St. Louis. I get put in a situation that, you know, has allowed me to have success, and immediately my confidence comes back. And my confidence comes back because of my belief system, knowing that, okay, stick with it. concentrate on the things I need to do and let the outside noise stay on the outside noise. And what being traded to St. Louis really allowed me to understand, or at least appreciate, is that life in Toronto became difficult in the sense too, where when you go to your workplace, you're focused on things that you need to work on to be a better player. But outside of your workplace, there was no separation, where you were constantly being reminded about the things that you did in your workplace, which, you know, really suffocated you at times, because you just, when you, like, that's the one thing about even when you go to work for your job, Teach, your coach. When you're at the rink, you dedicate yourself to a certain number of hours of the day being there and putting in the work. When you leave there, you kind of want to find that separation of, okay, you know what? I've put in my work today. Now I just want to enjoy the other things that life has to offer me, like your family or your friends or your social life, or just even, you know, the sense of relaxing. That's what being in St. Louis allowed me to do and allowed me to be, which was so refreshing for me, because now I knew that I didn't have to exhaust all my energy for 24 hours a day. I would only have to exhaust it for a certain couple of hours a day, where when I was there, give it all I have, make sure when I went there, I was doing the things to make me better every day. And the confidence comes back. I'm a go-to player on that team. You know, I end up being an impactful player on that team. And ultimately, our team has success. And I'm saying it's because of me. I'm saying it's because, you know, I end up being put in an environment that allows me to achieve that. And so I don't get to that point if I don't have my belief system, where anybody else in that situation that would have to deal with that type of adversity maybe calls it quits or maybe crumbles. And that's sort of how you justify the path that you are, how you create the path that you want in sports, in life, or whatever it is having a focus, staying with it, and knowing that it's not always going to be bells and whistles. It's not always going to be, you know, nobody, as much as people say they want an easy life sucks, because you don't really experience the toughnesses that make you better as a person or better as an athlete, where if everything was easy for you, you become complacent. And how much are you really enjoying going through that process? So I think that's what I appreciated the most throughout that journey, throughout that process, is that as difficult as it was at times, it was challenging in the sense that it allowed me to create more of a competitive juice in my blood that just made me want it even more. Because I, you know, as difficult as things may have seemed at times, there's people in life that are experiencing things more difficult. And I was able to be a hockey player doing the things that I love to do, play hockey for a living, you know, in the NHL with some meeting great people, and creating different life experiences and stuff, and ultimately, you know, setting up my post career.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it's that mindset of being able to take that satisfaction from the growth and through those challenges. And really, in many ways, the reward is actually the process. Like, that's the fun part.
Yeah.
You know, when you ultimately,
the fun part is proving people wrong in all this, right?
That's interesting. I mean,
what better joy do you have against somebody who doubts you, and you continue to defy the odds and you continue to prove them wrong? To me, that's the most satisfaction, is going up to that person who doubted you and saying, "See, I told you so." Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's just go a different way here for a moment. Who is the best player that you ever played with?
You know what, Teej? There isn't a right answer to that, because I've been lucky enough to play with so many great players. One of the players just recently in my career that was the best player combination of player-person combination that I ever played was Ryan O'Reilly. Because Ryan O'Reilly was the same guy that I just explained who I was, where, you know, got drafted as a mid-round pick in the OHL, got drafted as a mid-round pick in the NHL, but was always out to prove people wrong because of his work ethic. And the things that I saw him do, both on and off the ice, to make him prepare to be a pro, this guy knew how to find a separation between life at the rink and fun away from the rink, where he was a fun guy to be around away from the rink, loved having beers with the guys, loved socializing with guys, still does it. But he knew when he went to the rink, it was about being professional. It was about being serious. It was about doing the right things every day to make yourself better. Being the first guy on the ice, the last guy off the ice, you know, talking hockey, you know, watching hockey, just nonstop. And you have a real respect for guys that act that way, but also back it up with their play. So he's one guy, and I say him because I played with him in my last year in the NHL in Buffalo. You know, another guy that had a huge impact on my career was Matt Sundin. I mean, he was the first guy that, you know, that I, you know, looked up to in a locker room as a leader and as a captain and as a role model in my time in Toronto. And he's also a guy that really appreciated some of the difficulty that, you know, I was experiencing at the time as a young player in Toronto. I remember I was a 19-year-old in Toronto making a team that was coached by Pat Quinn, where the average age of this team was probably 33 years old, right? I mean, the next oldest guy for me was 27 years old. That was Rick Jackman, my first year in Toronto. So you can understand how difficult that may have been for a guy like myself or even anybody during that era to walk into that type of environment. And Matt Sundin made sure that I felt part of the guys made sure that I was part of the team. I felt part of the team. I was included in all team activities. And he believed in my abilities too. He was a big fan of the way I played, wanted to see me have success. Obviously, you know, some of the difficulties that I went through, injury there, but a huge impact on my life and definitely one of the greatest guys that I'll ever meet or play with. You know, to move on from there, you know, there's a lot of guys that I still, you know, keep in touch with Toronto, and includes the likes of Darcy Tucker, Shane Corson, Brian McCabe, Thomas Caberle. Like during the important part, I wouldn't say the important part, but the latter parts of my career where I was given more of a role on that Maple Leaf team, you know, I was part of the role with those guys that were impactful players. So, you know, that those relationships will never go away. You know, in St. Louis, best player that I ever played with in St. Louis would have to be Keith Tkachuk. You know, I was lucky to play with Paul Kariya too, who is, you know, probably going to be a Hall of Famer. But Keith Tkachuk was one of those guys too that just wore his heart on his sleeve, like played the game the hard way, but the right way, and just like was the ultimate competitor. And, you know, aside from playing the game, was one of the best guys to be around off the ice. And those are really guys that leave a lasting impression on you, right? Because they appreciate the game so much and the way that they're able to play it, but they also appreciate the life that comes with it and want to make sure that, you know, they really, you know, take away some of the positives or some of the things that they have the opportunity to enjoy being a professional athlete or being a hockey player. So, He was definitely, you know, very impactful in my time in St. Louis, which was close to 5 years there. And luckily for me, as short as it was, I wish it would have been longer, but my tenure in Detroit really, really changed my whole perspective of hockey and you know, being an NHLer, because they do it right over there, man. You talk about being a professional organization. When you're at the rink, it's all business. When you're away from the rink, just enjoy your life. And two guys that really taught me, I would say three guys that really taught me, you know, how to be that composed and just let the game be fun and let the game be a game of that you enjoy playing, is Henrik Zetterberg, Pavel Datsyuk, and Nicholas Cronwall. Like, those are guys that playing in St. Louis that you developed a hatred for because you played them so many times a year. But when you really got a chance to be their teammate and appreciate who they were and why they were so good, because it was the work they put in at the rink when they were there, and it was the life that they lived away from the rink when they were there, where they were just so appreciative with everything that they had with their life that they just enjoyed it. But knowing when they were at the rink, it was hockey, it was being a pro, and it was about representing yourself in the right way. And that's left a lasting impression on me.
Amazing. Now, what about the best coach you ever had?
Best coach I ever had when it comes to actually making you a better hockey player, Ken Hitchcock and Mike Babcock. They're very, very similar, but they knew how to coach winning hockey, which is something that is very, very difficult. As much as people may seem or think that, you know, it is easy, it's about developing a mindset with your players. It's understanding the emotions that go through the games. It's about understanding the decisions that need to be made within the games that they were so, so good at. And one of the other things that they really were good at were preparing you for your opponent. Like, these guys knew how to break down strengths and weaknesses for each opponent and get you prepared to play a game without overloading you with too much information. And that's where, you know, you felt like, you know, as you play a long career and you're experiencing different coaches and stuff, I felt like the coaches that really struggled were the ones that provided you with way too much information. Because hockey is a game of instincts. You want your foundation, which are the things you practice with, you know, your breakouts, your systems, your continuity with your partners or your line mates. Those are things you practice that you always lean on when it comes to foundational stuff. But you don't want to overload yourself with too much information, because the last thing you want to do when you're on the ice is think the game. Because when you're trying to play the game and thinking of it at the same time, you're lost. You're lost because now you're trying, instead of just making the play you know how to make because you've done it 100 times, now you're thinking of the play you're supposed to make because you're trying to process the information that the coach has been given to you. And ultimately, that's information overload. And I've seen guys struggle with that, where they're so skilled and they're so good, but they try to remember everything that the coach says before the game because they're trying to break down every little detail. Yeah, okay, you're preparing yourself, but that stuff doesn't happen every time on the ice. What happens on the ice in that small, you know, 200-foot rink is a game of instincts. You gotta read and react. And when you read and react, because when you trust your structure because it's the stuff you've practiced, well, then reading and reacting becomes very, very instinctually, and you're able to make the right play on most times other than not. And that's what Mike Babcock and Ken Hitchcock were really, really good at. So when you say best coach, those are two guys that I would categorize as guys that helped me transform the way I played to a more simple game. Because I always felt like, you know, there was things I needed to do to help push things or create things, where really, if you let the game come to you, and you trust your instincts and you trust your structure and you trust the things that you've practiced, those plays end up happening because you're not out of position and trying to make them happen. You're in position, letting the other guys be out of position as they happen. The coach that I have the most respect for and I had the most fun playing for was Craig Berube in Philadelphia. You talk about the ultimate respect between a player and coach. Like, when I went to Philadelphia, I had to settle into a role where I was an extra guy, and that's not always easy. You know, it's not, to me, that was the most frustrating part. And some of the most difficult part of my career was the last 4 years of my career, where, you know, I knew I was better than the role I was playing in, but I knew if I wanted to stay in the NHL, this was the role I had to accept, which is not easy for a lot of guys. Cause you, like I said, you trust your beliefs, you know, things you're capable of, and you're seeing a young guy come up every year and being put in your situation, taking your spot, and not being able to keep up or do the same things. And it just becomes frustrating. And you got to find the right things to say about them instead of the honest things to say about them. And that's where I really respected Craig Berube, because he understood the difficulty of me coming in, accepting that role, knowing that I was capable of playing a better role, but not given the chance to do it because there were decisions that were even out of his hands. You talk about the business of the game when you're playing on a Philadelphia blue line lineup with nine defensemen, but you're the ninth defenseman because eight of them have one-way contracts that can't be moved, right? And when you get your opportunity to play, the coach loves everything you do about the way you play, but doesn't get the chance to play you. So the thing that I really loved about him was that most coaches, if you're the ninth defenseman, on the team, they pretend you're not even there. This guy made it a priority every day to come talk to me and, you know, see how I was doing, how I was handling it, you know, making sure that, you know, I was still part of the process and still, you know, doing the things that I needed to do on a daily basis, you know, because in case I got the tap on the shoulder and my chance was to come, that I was ready. And so that's something that to this day, you know, I've developed a great relationship with him, even off the ice right now, where, you know, we share text messages on the daily, on the weekly, just, you know, shooting the shit with each other. And that's a lot of fun and a lot of, I think something that I'm really grateful for, to have those relationships with people that I played with or people that I, you know, played under. Because I've always said this too, and, you know, part of the reason why I was able to have early success in my post career is, in life and in hockey, you build relationships and you put yourself in, you know, different situations where you're meeting new people and stuff like that. And you may like things that people do, you may dislike things people do, but I've always learned that you should never burn any bridges in hockey or in life, no matter how you feel about somebody. Sometimes it's just better to be, you know, the bigger person and just, you know, bite the bullet and step away. Because in life, you don't know when you're going to need those relationships that you've created or that you maybe, you know, had a comment about to help you or to at least direct you into a certain situation, especially in the hockey world, where I've noticed that some of the coaches that I couldn't stand, you know, when I run into them, I say hi, I say how things are doing, how are things going with the family and stuff like that, because you want to be personable. You want to have that reputation of knowing you can be a guy that can be trusted and you can be a guy that you can have a conversation with about anything.
Carlo, there's been so many nuggets of wisdom that have come out of this conversation.
I apologize for ranting and talking for so long, but I just feel like we're on such a sensitive subject here that it's important for me to elaborate, because there's so many things that I've been through in my career.
No, it's perfect. And it's really, really cool for me to listen to this, because as we were talking before, you know, we kind of logged on, like, you know, we've known each other a long time. And first of all, it's amazing to see the success you've had after being the second best defenseman on your minor Bantam team. But,
I always looked up to you. You were the captain, man. It was your show.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, a little story about that. It's when you look back on your, you know, childhood and youth hockey days, like your perspective looking back is you pick up on things. And I remember we're at North Toronto Arena. I don't remember what age group we were. I think we're in the playoffs, and somehow you had a penalty shot. So you're going down on this penalty shot and you circled the puck with your stick before you ultimately scored. And at the time I'm on the bench, I'm thinking, that's pretty cool. Carlo scored. Great. You know, we're great. And, but now I don't know how this popped in my head, you know, in the last week or so, thinking about our conversation. And it's like, well, that's the stuff that now that I'm a coach and I scout and I evaluate players, like something simple like that is something that you take notice, because first of all, some courage, some creativity, and the confidence.
Shot in a playoff game. Yeah. And I pull the old fake around the puck, pull it to my backhand and roof it shelf.
Yeah. Right. And if you think back to that moment, like North Toronto, talk about at our age, that is the most pressure packed thing, because the entire league is at that game.
Watching. Yeah.
Every kid, every mom and dad that you know, you know, And you pull that off, and you know, but that's I mean, that's
it's hard to remember. I was a D-man. How did I get a breakaway that game?
Well, I was wondering about that. Like, did you have a breakaway and get hauled down, or did we get a penalty shot and did Kevin choose you to shoot?
No, I think I got hauled down. I think I'm not sure. I made a play on the blue line. I poked the puck past, and I was going in on a breakaway, and the guy tripped me from behind. I don't really know, but I do remember that penalty shot vividly because it was one of my greatest moments ever as a hockey player. The fact, and I practiced that move in practice, right? Because I was watching guys do it, you know, in the NHL or even on videos and stuff, where you just go in. And the thing is what I learned, and especially with my brother being a goalie, he always told me that always make the goalie think you're doing something different that you're going to do, right? So I went in, I pretended like I was going to make a play with the puck or at least try to mesmerize the goalie and then make a quick play at the stick and don't give him time to react. And ultimately it ended up working out for me and working out for us. I think we won the series that year as well too.
Went on a run. There's also the time when I almost fought your brother in a game of three puck because he kept shooting the puck down the ice.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that. I'm not surprised.
Fun
days, fun memories. Yeah, about how me and you, you know, created our relationship. Yeah, we talk about, turning points in my life. That year, that summer, I got cut from the Toronto Red Wings 2 days before training camp. And grew up with a twin brother and we were kind of stuck and had nowhere to go. And then our good friend, Kevin Rutledge, calls us up and says that you guys got a spot for both of us. And next thing you know, we're reunited and, you know, it was history after that. We created a fun spot to play with the Senators. We had some great success and, you talk about the relationships and the bonds we've created. I mean, I still keep in touch with almost all you guys on that team.
Yeah.
You know, you, Segretto, Matt Bacon, Matt Stajan. Who are some of the other guys?
Brian McLaughlin, Stewie.
McLaughlin, Brian Hayes. I work with Brian Hayes. You know?
Forgot about Hayes. Yeah.
So it's good.
Well, I've often thought about that team too and the environment that was created by Kevin and the other coaches that we had. And, you know, we had some good success in the playoffs and stuff, but we were never a top team in the league.
Underdog mentality.
Yeah, but look at yourself, Stage, Matt Foy, and, Chris Kern and Matt Bacon played in the OHL. And then we had other guys. Your brother played in the OHL, in pro. And then I'm probably forgetting other guys that came through that team with us, like
Brian Hayes had a
Hazy play in the OHL. Yeah. Matt Molson played on that team for a year or two.
Matt Molson, you talk about a guy. Remember in minor hockey, no one ever thought he would make it to the NHL. This guy stuck with. If anything, that guy's the most inspiring story because the path he creates to get to the NHL. I mean, here's a guy who just stuck with it, gets a scholarship. Goes to Cornell, ends up having a breakout season in Cornell, gets invited to the Islanders training camp, plays alongside John Tavares, and the next thing you know, it's history. He's carved out a multi-million dollar career in the NHL.
Amazing. Amazing.
You know?
But even the guys that didn't go on to play, like, they're all pretty much successful, and I do think that just that environment was special, especially in the greater Toronto area, GTHL or MTHL when we played. I mean, the craziness that goes on, and, we seem to have we had, like, the best-kept secret, I think, in terms of the environment that we played in. And
I agree.
It was outstanding. And, I mean, probably at this point, Carr, the only ones listening to this are guys that played on that team. So I'm gonna put a fork in this, and we can, I'll stop recording. We can crack a beer because it feels like we're going into reminiscing time. But, man, this was great. Like, I really enjoyed getting your stories and your perspective and the behind the scenes. And when you're talking about the hair standing up on your arms, like, I'm just listening to those stories and the same thing's happening to me. And it was a lot of fun. I really appreciate you connecting with me today.
Dude,
Dude, I enjoy doing this. It's nice reminiscing, and it's obviously nice reminiscing with a good friend like you. I think you got a good thing going here. I've complimented you. We've gotten to actually spend a lot more time just in this past year, you know, connecting with each other, you know, doing coaching chats with our old Mississauga Senators alumni. And I've complimented you on, you know, your work ethic and some of the things that you've really done that impressed me with your approach and your confidence in your beliefs. So good on you, man. Hopefully you guys can find a way to have a season this year. I think everybody wants life to return to normal, but really, really proud of what you've been able to accomplish so far too. And hopefully this is a sign of greater things to come.
Thanks, Carl. Appreciate it.
All right, buddy. Say hi to the fam.
You too.